drastically undermining our security. And you'd think that the Ukraine war would have shocked us out of this approach, but no.
Workers have taken to the streets of Brussels to demand peace negotiations.
We need to stop this war because it's affecting our workers, and our workers have already been affected with prices because of the COVID situation.
EU foreign ministers adopted a fresh round of sanctions against Iran on Monday over alleged human rights abuses. The grounds for such sanctions are vehemently rejected by Tehran. Critics say the West's policy towards Russia and Iran is being driven by Washington. Moscow and Tehran control the largest energy reserves in the world. Analysts say the EU's access to these markets is being hampered due to influence from the United States, and ultimately it is ordinary citizens who are paying the price. Also on Monday, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtaya updated EU foreign ministers on the appalling situation in the occupied territories. There was absolutely no discussion on the EU side regarding possible sanctions against Israel. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The United States suffered its worst mass shooting in nearly a year when a gunman killed 10 and wounded 10 others in California. In the nation's third largest city of Chicago, at least 30 people were shot and 7 killed over the weekend, illustrating how routine gun violence has become across the country. The California gunman showed symptoms of paranoia and mental illness, but for the last 40 years, liberal economic measures have gutted not only health services, but sent jobs overseas, eliminated anti-poverty measures, and fostered a climate of perpetual instability and insecurity.
People feel like it is every person for themselves. And for some people, then the answer to that is going to be, yeah, it's worth the risk. It's worth the, you know, it's worth taking the steps to engage in, you know, I don't know, theft, carjackings, breaking into homes, you know, and ultimately, you know, you're going to have certain situations with that will create, you know, instances of gun violence and murder.
Last year saw almost double the number of mass shootings compared with just 4 years ago. In 2022, death rates from firearms reached their highest level in 3 decades. For many big city mayors, even Democratic ones, more cops is the answer. However, anti-police sentiment has exploded, most recently at a protest in Atlanta against yet another killing by police, and many say more militarism just isn't the solution.
Real community safety measures, which does not mean more police within the neighborhoods, but actually means going through building real community bases of support that lean in the direction of violence prevention, but ultimately that can't be separated out from the real needs, you know, of housing, healthcare, education that working people face on the daily.
Following the California massacre, a congressman said that mass shootings are a uniquely American experience. With the termination of many coronavirus-era assistance programs and another recession on the horizon, few expect that such experiences will decrease. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago. United States President Joe Biden has just reached the halfway mark of his term, and perhaps the best word to sum up the past 2 years is a new phrase, polycrisis, which is defined as the simultaneous creation of several catastrophic events. Most of them started with foreign policy. Biden totally backtracked on his promise to re-enter the JCPOA pact on Iran's nuclear energy agreement, and then charged into exacerbating the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. Sanctions on Russia have backfired so badly that the average family has lost over a month's salary since Biden took office, or $7,400. Biden came to power with total control of Congress, thanks to big campaign promises of rebuilding after the devastation of the coronavirus lockdowns.
The Build Back Better plan that was supposed to give you all these, you know, workers' rights, it was supposed to, like, you know, put so much money into infrastructure, it was supposed to improve the education system. Barely any part of the Build Back Better plan made it past legislation.
Biden's approval rating is currently the lowest of his presidency at just 40%. The Democrats lost control of the lower House of Representatives in the midterm elections due to widespread disillusionment. The country now faces 2 years of congressional dysfunction, and many wonder if the progressive spirit of 2020 can be recaptured.
Every time Republicans have control, they will use whatever power they can, little or a lot, to get what they want passed. Whenever Democrats are in charge, whatever the Republicans left them, they'll cling on to it no matter how far, you know, right it advanced. And so the strategy here is it's bipartisan if you look at the big picture. The Republicans move things right. They take away all these social and civil liberties, and the Democrats, when elected, preserve just exactly where they are so that when the Republicans win again, they can move them further right.
Record inflation, another recession, a divided Congress, and no end to forever war. The Biden era can't be defined by just one crisis. A recent poll found that 60% of Democrats don't want Biden to run for re-election in 2024. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Afghanistan is witnessing its coldest winter in 15 years, adding to the misery of millions who are already struggling with multiple crises. Umar Khan, a Kabul resident and a father of seven, lives in a cold shack. Two of his children are severely sick. Without a job and relief assistance, he has been unable to afford food, heating, and medication for his family. The situation has triggered fears of human losses.
As I told you, this son of mine collects plastic bottles and waste for one-time heating during the day. I was unemployed almost the entire year, and I couldn't afford fuel or winter clothes for my children. This other son is suffering from the disease of kidney stones. In such a situation, I'm afraid my children may go undernourished or freeze to death. This is a catastrophic moment, and I'm wondering what to do.
Meanwhile, the United Nations has put Afghanistan on its list of 11 crisis hotspots in 2023. The UN survey shows that two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, over 28 million people, need humanitarian aid. Heads of households, like Shah Gul, say they can't cope with the harsh winter alone.
We can't afford more than one meal per day. We used to buy some loaves of bread and potatoes, but today they're also gone from the table. We're not living a life in this cold room with no blanket or enough clothes. When the Taliban took power, everyone was saying that Afghanistan is going to see peace. But what about jobs, earning an income and food? We need the Taliban administration and aid groups to reach out to us before we die from hunger or cold.
This comes as major aid groups have suspended their missions following the Taliban's ban on female workers. For many Afghans, the services provided by the NGOs were a lifeline that has been removed at the worst possible moment. Afghanistan is grappling with economic, political, and human rights crisis. Experts said the Taliban administration's restrictive measures, coupled with Western sanctions, are worsening the situation. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Of high school students have hit the streets of the Italian capital to rally against what they called a school system in grave decay at the service of companies and private interests. The protest took aim at a 2015 school reform named the Good School by then Prime Minister Matteo Renzi. The reform radically transformed the Italian education system, introducing measures including granting more powers to principals, a new national recruitment process for teachers, and obligatory work experience programs for high school students.
The 2015 reform brought private interests into our schools. From that year onwards, the company's interests came first, not our preparation. The rat race had just begun.
The reform has legalized the exploitation of us students. We are obliged to work unpaid for businesses. It's completely useless and unfair.
Students at the rally said the initiative was also called to remember Lorenzo Parrelli, an 18-year-old boy who was crushed by a metal bar while on a school training placement at a factory in northern Italy a year ago.
Lorenzo was assassinated by the work placement program. He was working in a factory for free, with no safety measures in place. Two more people have died under that program and simply in the interest of the capitalistic economy.
Recently, an international family caused a stir by saying they had to leave Italy due to the appalling conditions of the education system. While schools vary around the country, statistics show that educational standards overall are consistently below the EU average.
Italy is the country in the European Union that invests the least in public education. According to data by the European Statistical Agency Eurostat, Italy allocates about 8% of its public spending in this field, placing it last after Greece and well below the EU average of about 10%. Max Civili, Rome.
Women scientists and cultural and high-ranking political figures from 28 countries across the globe gathered in the Iranian capital, Tehran, to celebrate the efforts and achievements of women worldwide in a conference dedicated to women of influence. The first of its kind, an initiative of Iran's First Lady, Jamile Alam-ul-Hoda, based on what used to be a ceremony limited to Iranian women in previous years. The conference was aimed at showing appreciation for women of influence while offering support and help for them to grow and promote their ideas, as Ensia Khazali, Iran's Vice President for Women and Family Affairs, stated in her opening remarks. With Anna Hakopian, the wife of Armenia's prime minister, emphasizing the important role women play in promoting tolerance and peaceful coexistence. About 300 foreign guests are taking part in this conference, 70 of them female officials and politicians. The conference itself is held in three different levels: cultural, scientific, and a special panel for ministers and first ladies. Morning and afternoon sessions were held to provide a platform for the participants in order to share their ideas and valuable experiences regarding the challenges that women face in today's world. The conference wrapped up with Iran's First Lady thanking her guests for supporting the initiative and a special ceremony where the Goharshad Prize was awarded to seven of the influential women, recognizing their outstanding performance and contributions. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Already in 2023, 30 refugees have drowned in the Mediterranean Sea as they attempted to reach the EU, according to figures from the United Nations. The EU's border and coast guard agency, Frontex, has in the past been lambasted for pushing back unsafe boats, resulting in deaths. On Thursday, the new head of the agency vowed to end this practice.
I am responsible for the fact that my people don't participate in anything called a pushback. So I think that is absolutely clear. That is the legal framework I work in. So that's it.
According to OLAF, the EU's anti-fraud office, at least 2,000 refugees drowned in the Aegean Sea during 2020 and 2021 as they were pushed back from the EU coastline by Frontex. The agency prevented at least 40,000 asylum seekers from reaching the EU, which blatantly breaks international law. In just 10 months, the EU has welcomed more than 4 million Ukrainian refugees. They are afforded all the same rights as EU citizens. However, if you're from a different part of the world, torn up by Western powers, it's a different story. We visited a shelter for Afghans in Brussels.
Before we come in the Europe, we think the Europe care about women, care about children. Now we come in here, not. They don't care about women, they don't care about children.
When the children go to school, they need food, they need clothes. And for everything, we need to work. So we need the job permit.
There are no such problems for Ukrainians. Of course, that's to be welcomed. But rights groups are asking why the discrimination. EU Home Affairs ministers will meet in Stockholm, Sweden next Thursday to agree on a more effective strategy to deport asylum seekers who don't meet refugee status criteria. Campaigners point out there are no plans to adopt a similar policy for refugees arriving here from Western Ukraine, arguably a relatively safe region. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Could the UK witness a renewed push by religious communities to remove a controversial relationship and sex education, also known as RSE lessons, in British schools? It appears the appetite is huge after an online petition on the UK government website rocketed to well over 130,000 signatures in just a few days.
The petition focuses on tackling just one aspect of RSE, which many parents find concerning, LGBT relationship education, which is a lifestyle not condoned by the three Abrahamic faiths. However, there is a growing anti-RSE movement, which is campaigning for the total removal of RSE from the state curriculum, as activists believe that it is parents who should be teaching their kids about this sensitive subject matter rather than state-funded teachers.
RSE is currently mandatory in British schools, teaching kids about relationships and sex education, including same-gender relations. The lessons have been marred with controversy, sparking Muslim-majority parent protests as far back as 2019. Parents alleged their kids were being indoctrinated by secular worldviews and what they call LGBT propaganda.
We believe that, that the subjects, they should be able to withdraw from this type of subject. So we, the No Outsiders campaign, so we just want to able to have control over what they are being taught.
Speaking to a local Muslim activist, Shaquille Afsar explained why he feels the petition received so much support.
I think it would have got a lot more signatures if there wasn't this pro-LGBT narrative in our society where if you speak against them, you are completely shut down, locked up, and the keys thrown away. I think there would have been a lot more. And I think with the people who have signed, they are people who are at the forefront of understanding what's happening. There are many people who don't really understand the situation. They don't even really know what's happening until their children are coming home with these books. I believe that if there was a transparent media, this petition would have signatures in the millions.
So far, the protests have largely received negative coverage, with the establishment refusing to budge on the RSE curriculum. Activists believe this uncompromising stance could boil over to more parent protests in 2023. Robert Carter, London.
In the limelight.
The administration of US President Joe Biden is under pressure to drop the charges against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Many human rights organizations have expressed their opposition to the extradition and trial of Julian Assange in the United States. But the Biden White House has not paid any attention to these requests. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Joe Biden has been charged with hypocrisy for demanding the release of journalists detained around the world, as he continues to seek the extradition of the WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, from Britain. As a candidate in 2020, Biden released a powerful statement about the importance of press freedom. Joe Biden said, "At least 360 people worldwide are currently imprisoned for their work in journalism. We all stand in solidarity with these journalists." On Friday, 20th of January 2023, the campaign aimed to pressure Joe Biden to drop charges against Julian Assange, move to Washington, D.C. for the hearing of the Belmarsh Tribunal, the gathering of legal experts and supporters named after the London prison where Julian Assange is being detained. Organised by Progressive International in partnership with the Wau Holland Foundation, it was held at the National Press Club close to the US Capitol building, which houses the US Congress. The hearing was held in the same venue where Julian Assange in 2010 exposed the collateral murder video showing US aircrew gunning down Iraqi civilians, the first of hundreds of thousands of leaked secret military documents and diplomatic cables published in major newspapers around the world. Collateral Murder is 39 minutes of unedited leaked video footage from a gun cam that had caused severe embarrassment in Washington as it showed the US military drone attacking Al-Amin al-Thaniya, a suburb of Baghdad, and killing 12 innocent Iraqi civilians. The Belmarsh Tribunal co-chairperson, Sireko Horvat, said, "President Biden is normally advocating freedom of the press, but at the same time continuing the persecution of Julian Assange." He also warned that continuing the prosecution could serve as a bad example to other governments around the world. He said, "This is an attack on press freedom globally. That's because the United States is advancing what I think is really the extraordinary claim that it can impose its criminal secrecy laws on a foreign publisher who was publishing outside of the United States." Currently, Julian Assange faces 18 charges over WikiLeaks' publication of classified documents, most of which were leaked by former U.S. Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning. Manning has stated that she acted on her own initiative in sending the documents to WikiLeaks and not at the urging of Assange. She was sentenced to 35 years in prison but was later released after former President Barack Obama commuted her sentence in 2017. The Bloomberg News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. The campaign to free WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange is being stepped up following support from the presidents of all major Latin American countries. The politicians have sided with the Free Assange campaign in urging US President Joe Biden to drop the charges against Assange and set him free. Assange is being held in Belmarsh Prison in London, England, as he continues to fight being extradited to the United States. Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva said, "Julian Assange needs to be defended by all of us who love democracy, who love freedom of the press, freedom of trade unions, who love freedom of organization." WikiLeaks editor-in-chief Christine Hafenson and WikiLeaks ambassador Joseph Farrell have held a series of meetings in recent weeks in Latin American countries, including Mexico, Bolivia, Brazil, and Argentina. The Mexican president raised the issue of Julian Assange at a recent summit with Joe Biden and has used his daily briefing to highlight his continuing unjust detention. President of Argentina Alberto Fernandez said, "For justice to be done, the United States needs to drop the charges against Julian Assange and put an end to the ongoing extradition proceedings." Mexico's president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, said, "If Assange is taken to the United States and sentenced to the maximum penalty, we must begin the campaign to dismantle the Statue of Liberty. It is no longer a symbol of freedom." Meanwhile, Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has been approaching US government officials to persuade them to drop the espionage charges filed against Julian Assange. Anthony Albanese said recently that he had raised the issue of the continued detention of Julian Assange in meetings with US officials and was seeking to bring the matter to a close. Albanese said he would continue to advocate for Julian Assange's release. American officials claim his journalism endangered America's national security with the release of classified documents in 2010. Julian Assange's supporters say he's a hero victimized for exposing U.S. war crimes in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. If extradited to the United States, he would face a sentence of up to 175 years in a maximum security prison. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered this story and tells us more. Major news outlets like the New York Times have called on the Biden administration to drop charges against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. The Guardian, Le Monde, Der Spiegel, El País all joined forces with the New York Times to oppose the charges against Julian Assange, insisting that publishing the material WikiLeaks has released is not a crime. The media outlets wrote recently, obtaining and publishing sensitive information is a core part of the daily work of journalists. On 28th of September 2010, the five major news outlets collaborated to release excerpts from 250,000 documents obtained by Julian Assange in the Cablegate leak. The material, leaked to WikiLeaks by the then American soldier Chelsea Manning, exposed the inner workings of US diplomacy around the world. The editors and publishers of the five major newspapers that first published those revelations insisted that the prosecution of Julian Assange is a direct attack on media freedom. They wrote, "This indictment sets a dangerous precedent and threatens to undermine America's First Amendment and the freedom of the press." They added, "Obtaining and disclosing sensitive information when necessary in the public interest is a core part of the daily work of journalists. If that work is criminalized, our public discourse and our democracies are made significantly weaker." The letter concluded by saying, 12 years after the publication of Cablegate, it is time for the US government to end its prosecution of Julian Assange. Recently, supporters of Assange gathered to form a human chain outside the British Parliament, the House of Commons in London, to demand his release and an end to an attempt by the United States to have him extradited to face criminal charges in the US. The protesters, who held posters reading "Free Assange, End Extradition," "Journalism is not a crime," and "Prosecute War Crimes, Not Julian Assange," formed a human chain that stretched from the House of Commons perimeter railings and led towards nearby Westminster Bridge to the other side of the River Thames.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Another mass shooting in the U.S. 10 people have been killed in L.A. near a Chinese lunar celebration event. What has become a staple of life in America, it appears. And the question still remains, why does America tolerate mass shootings that are taking place due to firearm possessions? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at this recurring crisis there and what role the gun lobby, the NRA, has, along with why U.S. politicians and the U.S. president himself have failed to stop this phenomenon. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the program. Richard Becker, an anti-war activist from Answer Coalition, joins us from San Francisco. Also joining us, Margaret Kimberly, co-founder of the Black Agenda Report, who joins us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Another sad day for the U.S. when it comes to mass shootings there, Richard Becker. 10 dead in gun violence near the Chinese Lunar Year celebrations. And the way that this was described was a shooter with a machine gun carrying a large number of rounds, or carrying a number of rounds of ammunition so that he could reload, is what how he was sighted during action. What is your initial reaction to this?
Well, it's horrific. It's just horrific. And, you know, we've seen the mass killings now in Uvalde in Buffalo, very near where I was from originally, but all over the country. And it's true that I think there's been 30 already in this year, in 2023. And you know, it's a you also have to think when we hear this is the latest reports and we see these terrible casualties and the injuries of those who survive, life-changing injuries in many cases. And, you know, immediately what I was thinking today was thinking back to 2005 when George W. Bush passed a law that was called the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act. And what it did was basically say that the arms makers are exempt. They are protected by the federal government from being having any responsibility for what their products are used for. And there's no doubt that they know what their products are being used for, because the huge number of weapons that are being produced and sold inside of the United States are bound to end in like what we've seen again today. And the U.S. government has protected, it has carved out protections. It is carved out protections for the arms makers. It's carved out protection from criminal liability or going to jail for any of those responsible for the opioid crisis. It protects the rich and the big corporate interests, and then says that, you know, the leaders come back and talk about, you know, who have suffered these losses and these tragedies are in our thoughts and prayers. I mean, it's the cynicism is incredible.
Okay, since you talked about the number of arms being produced or guns being produced, I have to then go to that stat, because stats speak for themselves. So, Margaret Kimberly, the gun ownership in the U.S., it says, based on the latest, that the U.S. ratio of 120.5 firearms per 100 residents, which is up from 88 per 100 in the year from the year 2011. But then more interestingly was when the NRA, based on a simple Google search, which is that National Rifle Association, in information related to that, it said that the number of privately owned firearms has more than doubled from about 192 million to more than 405 million. 405 million, including more than 167 million handguns. Okay, so there's money in it, there's profits that are being made, but the fact that these gun manufacturers are exempt from accountability, they have to be protected. Are we looking at the NRA being that modem or that channel for their protection?
Well, you know, they're not the only corporate interests that are protected from any liability. Vaccine makers are protected from liability. Airlines have great protection from liability. They don't even have to protect the country when they don't schedule flights and cancel flights. So it's part of what's happening in this country where corporate interests are in control. We have an oligarchy in this country, so it could be the NRA, it could be Big Pharma, it could be any number of entities. But the big problem here goes back to the beginnings of American history. This is a settler colonial state, and this mentality that this is a country to be conquered, that other people are to be subjugated, is one that still resonates with millions of people. I also think that as this country is a failed state, that is the hard truth of the matter, as conditions, living conditions for people deteriorate, as people become more and more insecure economically, I believe those people who are frail psychologically are inspired to act on their worst impulses. And I think every incident leads to another. These people who need help inspire one another. So when there's one mass shooting, another generally follows fairly quickly. And so I think this combination of this mentality that says it's okay to be violent, it's beneficial to be violent, and you can't separate the domestic from the international. You can't have a country with a huge military budget which claims the right to kill people all around the world. You cannot be surprised when individuals feel like they have the right to kill when they want to.
Okay. I'm interested in your, you mentioned psychological problems. I'm interested as to why you chose that to being one of the factors for what you just said.
Well, I think it's obvious. There are people, many people in this country who are just unhinged, who are it's not a technical term, who are out of their minds. And I think the combination of the deterioration in life, for example, there are fewer and fewer living wage jobs. The safety net that we have is always threatened. People can't count on work. They can't count on having the ability to care for themselves. There's more and more insecurity. And I think when you combine that with people who, I mean, and they always exist, do they not? People who need mental health care. And then you combine that with this country that's historically been very violent and where the political system protects this type of violence and others. These people now are, I believe, inspired. And when you don't handle it, when there was no crackdown, then, of course, each one inspires the next.
All right, so let's dive into that issue if we can, because it's pretty shocking, Richard Becker, what our guests there touched on when it comes to the number of deaths overall, which needs to be mentioned here. We're looking at 40,000 roughly, or between 40 to 45,000 that are dying every year in the U.S. because of firearms in one form or another. Which translates into more than 110 Americans that die every day, okay? But what's very shocking and at the same time very interesting, but more shocking than that, is with the breakdown. When you take a look at the breakdown, you have a little over 19,000 based on the homicides that happen, but 24,000, which is more than homicides, is because of suicides. That's pretty shocking. I mean, I don't know if many people are aware of that. They know that U.S. is a dangerous place, and of course firearms is a problem that the U.S. has, but not many people, I think, are aware that it's because of suicides. Are the reasons given, first of all, what do you think of that? Are the reasons given there by our guest, Margaret, reasons for people to take their lives, and what does that say about the state of mental health of many Americans in the U.S.?
Well, yes, I completely agree with what Ms. Kimberly said, and the you know, we live in a very atomized society. People are on their own. And if you're lucky and, you know, you have a good income and, you know, your family has stability and so forth, you know, still you can run into a lot of problems. But if you don't have those things, and particularly if you don't have income, if you become...
Richard Becker, I think we lost you. Okay, let me go to you, Margaret Kimberly. Margaret Kimberly, we were talking about this shocking stat about the suicides, which you touched on. Now, based on what we're looking at, there are pros and cons on this. Advocates for these stricter gun laws say that, you know, you need to have lawmakers devoting some resources for people in order to prevent them from taking their lives with firearms. At the same time, you have gun control opponents who have framed the gun violence as a symptom of a broader mental health problem, which obviously shows that they say there's a crisis there, and it's not the life being taken away is not due to the firearm, it's due to the person. What would you say to them?
Well, I think it's both. You know, we have these people have easy access to these guns with large magazines, which can fire many bullets, which no one, I believe, has any reason to own. There's no reason. These are military grade weapons, and anyone can get their hands on them when there's no justification for it. Now, the opponents of gun control will say that they may be a marksman or it's target shooting or hunting. I don't understand why, though, these cannot be regulated. But the NRA, an organization I do not support at all, has a lot of support around the country. So I think it's a combination of two things. The statistic you gave about how many gun fatalities are caused by suicides is a huge number.
Right.
And I think to the point I was making before, that's something that isn't talked about very much, the suicides that happen with guns. But as the other guest said, we have this atomized society, people on their own, worsening economic conditions, a political system that does not address the needs of the people, but only addresses the needs of the oligarchy. All of these things combine to create a kind of thinking among millions of people, people who see other people as their enemy, people who don't see any common cause with others, and then may have mental health problem. And then, of course, when it's not taken care of, when nothing changes, each act inspires the next one. So I hate to say this, but it's inevitable that we're going to have these mass shootings until something changes. But we live in a society where the system doesn't help the people in so many other ways, so we should not be surprised about this either.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, we have Richard Becker back with us also. Richard Becker, when you had that school shooting that happened in Texas that left 19 children dead and two adults also as part of that, basically 21 people to have been killed, it was very, how can I say, it's very telling what the U.S. President Joe Biden said when he said, or posed as a question when he said, when are we going to stand up to the gun lobby? What does that say about the gun lobby?
Well, the gun lobby is quite powerful. I mean, many, many politicians have received $1 million or multi-million-dollar donations over the years. Mitt Romney, who's considered one of the moderate Republicans, I think, is the leader with more than $13 million in donations from the gun lobby. And, you know, it's very true that a huge number of weapons are already dispersed in the population. And in order to begin to halt this, there has to be consequences for the gun makers. And, you know, and there haven't been. You know, when the opioid makers like Purdue Pharmacy would send a million opioid pills to a town of 300 people, they didn't think that, you know, somehow those were all going to be used for, you know, for pain purposes, or that there were going to be those kind of health problems in that town that required that number. No, they knew that this was going to go into the market, into the illegal market, to the black market, and become immensely powerful and immensely profitable. And it did. And the same thing goes for the weapons makers. They know that these guns that are being distributed in such vast quantities throughout the United States, and such an increase in the number of guns in circulation domestically, that that's going to mean more mass shootings, more mass killings. But they are protected. They are protected the same way that Margaret Kimberly mentioned, so many other industries are, so many other capitalist industries are.
Okay, the question of accessibility is very important over here. Now, some thought when Joe Biden signed that historic law that's said to be the one of the strongest, if not the strongest, gun control laws last year, was going to somehow put a dent into what has occurred in terms of mass shootings or firearms, deaths as a result of firearms, but that did not happen. So, you know, they're asking for some of the proposals, stricter gun control laws, universal background checks to be stronger, or banning certain types of weapons. Okay, these are all sound good, but they haven't worked, even though there's been strides made in it. But the question of accessibility, I think, is the bigger problem. And Margaret Kimberly, I don't know what part of New York you are at, but I'm sure you're familiar with the Bronx. And I'm going to just name an example. Co-op City in the Bronx. And this is a real example of the way guns are accessible. Co-op City in the Bronx, one of the streets that is not even in a very bad neighborhood. You have people that are just hanging out, and you can go to them and say, "What's up?" They say, "What do you need?" And if you say you need a handgun, they come back and tell you, "We'll have it for you within the hour." Okay, that's the reality of what's going on in the streets. How can that then be stopped? I mean, you know, what can the police do? Because it goes back to the streets and the U.S. being awash with guns. So there needs to be a breaking point there. How can that be addressed?
Well, it's interesting. I'm in New York City. It's interesting you mentioned New York. You know, handgun laws vary by state. And New York State has very strict gun laws, except guns come from other states that aren't very far away. So if you go, I don't know, drive 4 or 5 hours away to Virginia, which has very loose gun regulations, almost none, that is where people get guns and then bring them back to New York.
What do you mean none? I'm sorry to jump in. Why loose and why none? That doesn't make sense, does it?
Because people, doesn't make sense to me, but there are people across the country who, they don't want gun regulations. This is something where there is a divide, a popular divide, and there are places where people believe in their right to bear arms, as they call it, their right to own firearms as powerful as they want, as many as they want. And the people who own guns actually own a lot of guns, which is why there's so many per person, at least one per person. So you have people in these states, people run for office promising not to enact gun legislation. So you have part of the population who are quite happy not to have any regulations, but their decisions impact those of us, like in New York, who do want gun regulation. So people can come to New York City, to the Bronx, to Brooklyn, to any part of the city with guns from other places, and they can do with them whatever they choose. So even in a state which has stricter laws, handguns are still very easily accessible, even though that access is not legal.
So is that the case, Richard Becker? I mean, based on your viewpoint, that I don't know what is it like in San Francisco, but that you can maybe travel outside of San Francisco, maybe go to some part of L.A., maybe go to, projects where the guns might be available there on the streets readily if you were to peruse the neighborhood and for the right price get one. Is that how it stands? Because you two are at the opposite end of the U.S., one in the east, one in the west.
Yeah, and you know, I have to say, I'm from upstate New York, western part of New York State. I haven't lived there in a long time, but I knew a lot of people. I didn't do hunting myself, but I knew a lot of people who were hunters. You don't go hunting with a semi-automatic rifle or a handgun. That's illegal to do. That's not what it's for. So you have to ask, well, what is it for? What are they producing? What is the and a lot of the gun industry, by the way, is based in Connecticut. A lot, and they're very powerful in Connecticut politics. And so they're shipping out all these weapons that, you know, supposedly have some good purpose for them or, you know, healthy purpose. And they know they're not. They really know that. And as far as California goes, San Francisco, okay, San Francisco probably has less guns per capita than the average city. I'm pretty sure it does. But there are gun shows. There's not only gun dealers, there's gun shows. You can go to Walmart and get guns, and gun shows happen. And one of the things that the gun lobby has resisted is having strict background checks at gun shows, where, you know, they'll be like hundreds of gun makers or gun dealers, not the makers, but the dealers more, in like a big place like a convention center. And people go around, they look at them, and they buy them. And, you know, there can be some background checks, but it's very, very loose and easy to avoid any limitations on your ability to gain weapons, either in the black market, either, you know, illegally or legally.
Even politicians have not been immune to this, Margaret Kimberly. I was looking down a list of U.S. Congress members killed or wounded in office. And I'm quite surprised that it goes all the way back to the year 1789. I'm not going to rehash all the different congressmen, which is broken down by their party affiliation. However, you know, what comes to mind is when Reagan, for example, was shot, or you have other instances of U.S. politicians that are not immune from guns. And yet, the U.S. is still looking at this being a problem. So where do you go from here? I mean, you know, here's another mass shooting, 10 people to have been killed. I'm sorry to say, I think it's going to happen again. And I'm sure that's what people in the administration are telling each other. But then what are they going to do about it?
Well, it's interesting. You quoted President Biden, who said, when are we going to do something? As if he has nothing to do with what sort of legislation is passed in the country as president. But he knows, having been in politics for decades, he knows.